So I'm with Mark Roswell, more commonly known as Darshan, the amazingly famous Canadian comedian who has been a friend of China's for decades now. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Darshan. Thank you. Yeah,
I'm just used to using the name Darshan because nobody knows Mark Roswell.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I didn't have to look you up on the internet. No, Darshan is a very, very well-known and well-respected name in China. So I wanted to talk to you, Darshan, because your experience in China and as well as your knowledge of the Chinese language gives you this very unique perspective on China and on the relationship between China and the world, to use a Chinese way of looking at things, and some really interesting insights. So I wanted to talk to you today a little bit about what you've seen in China about what constitutes friendship and real friendship, some thoughts on identity and identity bubbles and how difficult it is sometimes to cross those bubbles, and the mutual misperceptions that can arise about these things and when these things are not clearly understood. So let's start with talking a bit about the phenomenon of Darshan. When you came to China, how did it all start?
Okay. Well, I started studying Chinese in 1984 in Toronto, first year university. And looking back, you know, those were sort of the heady early days of reform and opening, when Deng Xiaoping was Time's Man of the Year and China's economic miracle was really starting to take off, right? 1978 was a political change. Pretty well by the early 80s, the economic change in China was quite obvious. And I remember just having sort of a general curiosity about China and, you know, typical 18 or 19 year old just wanting to learn more about the world, and here China is coming out. And I remember at the time there was a magazine that said, blaring headline, the languages we'll need the most in the future are the ones we're studying the least. With a picture, you know, with a graphic of Zhongwen, the two characters for Chinese language. And unfortunately, that's probably still true 30-some years later. But I did a degree in Chinese language and literature at the University of Toronto, graduated in 1988, and came over to China to continue my studies in 1988 at Peking University.
And that's where you were talent spotted.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the whole purpose of coming to China, I had my degree. The whole purpose was sort of to get out and experience real life in China. So when the television station came to Peking University and said, we're looking for a foreigner, not necessarily fluent, but proficient in Chinese, to host a TV show, I thought, why not? In fact, you know what? Of course, a lot of foreigners have had that experience in China of doing something wild and zany that you would never do back in your home country and appearing on TV and doing some wild show. Of course, in 1988, it was a relatively new idea. It was, and you know, to use the later sort of internet terminology, it went viral. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody expected that the show would be that successful. And of course, those are what I call the Ed Sullivan days of Chinese TV. So 550 million people all watched one show.
Yeah.
You don't get those kind of audiences anymore, right? But you know, once on Ed Sullivan and you've made it, or Johnny Carson in the Tonight Show. And then that, you know, I had a very vague idea that I wanted to somehow do an East meets West kind of career. I wasn't sure if I was going to be a sinologist and pursue an academic career, or would I become a diplomat, or would I get into business? I wasn't quite sure. And this career in performing and entertaining and media work just sort of dropped out of the sky and hit me on the head. Mm-hmm. And I often say I recognized a good thing when it smacked me in the face.
So that's right. And Darshan was born.
I took it and I ran with it. And that's coming up 29 years now this next year.
Right, yeah. And so Darshan means big mountain. How did you decide on that name?
Well, the name, it comes from the character that I played in the very first skit. So this is December of 1988. And the premise of the skit was that it was two actors who were obviously foreign. My partner was a girl from Brazil who had actually gone through middle school in China. So she was absolutely fluent. And I had studied Chinese for 4 years in Toronto. So I was functional, but still had a very heavy foreign accent. But the premise of the skit was that we were just doing something that was so down to earth. An ordinary Chinese family, husband and wife having an argument through the doorway and using like heavy sort of taxi driver slang.
Right.
So it wasn't sort of proper erudite Chinese. It was slang, and it was just this so ultimately Chinese sort of down-to-earth kind of skit, but it was performed by two foreigners. So in that sense, it was the, it was that sort of that was the comedic contrast.
Mm.
And Dashan, the name stuck because it's a typical peasant name.
Right.
You know, foreigners never, when we're given Chinese names by our Chinese teachers, they're usually very erudite and poetic.
I
don't know, like in English, there's also an expression in Chinese, kan dashan, which literally means sort of to chew, not literally, but figuratively means chew the fat, sit around and talk about nothing all day.
Right.
So that implies somebody who has the gift of gab and this peasant name. And it would be kind of like, you know, being called Johnny Chew Fat or something.
Right.
I don't know if that's the same expression in Australian or not. Chew the fat or...
Yeah, absolutely.
To Kandashan is to just sit around and chop the mountain all day. You know, just engage in pointless banter.
Perfect.
So what a great name for a comedian, right?
Exactly.
Pointless banter.
Pointless banter. That is a good name. So you've, after over this almost 3-decade career, you've really come to be known as a real friend of China. And can you tell us a bit about what that means, why that's important?
Yeah, that's a bit of a Chinese cliche, isn't it? The friend of China. Of course, the early friends of China were the Norman Bethunes and Edgar Snows of the world, who had either joined or somehow supported or sympathized with the Chinese Revolution. I think in a broader sense, you know, the Chinese have traditionally, especially in the last 150 years, of course, have seen their relationship with the outside world as fundamentally antagonistic or problematic, that the world is against us. And, you know, the fight against colonialism and Japanese aggression and that history, the Boxer Rebellion or the Opium Wars, that whole history is something that's very... front and center in China's perception of their relationship to the world, that history of humiliation and whatnot. So the idea that of this, you know, this very angry world, there are a small number of these friends of China that do sort of understand us and are on our side. It's a little bit less politicized now, I suppose. It more refers now to someone who just a foreigner who speaks Chinese, who understands a little bit about Chinese culture. Because again, apart from that sort of history of humiliation angle, there's also a deep held belief that our language and culture in China are far too complex, that foreigners will never understand us. We're the world's, you know, on one hand, they really want to encourage foreigners to learn Chinese. And on the other hand, they keep telling us, it's the hardest language in the world. You'll never learn it. You can't possibly learn it, but please try.
Mm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's been my experience as well, that, you know, that students that I've taught will say that it doesn't matter how long you spend in China or how, you know, how many generations your family's been in China, you can never be Chinese, because it's just impossible to actually grasp all the aspects of Chineseness.
Yeah, but you know, I of course didn't speak a word of Chinese before the age of 19, and now I have this reputation for being sort of the uber China hand, the white guy or the foreigner who became absolutely fluent in Chinese. And I didn't start till the age of 19. So that sort of throws that common myth out the window. I mean, obviously learning language, the earlier the better, but it's not that impossible. I think one of the things that foreigners or Westerners have problems learning Chinese is that, first of all, we very rarely start before the age of university age. And secondly, it's very difficult to really have an immersion environment in China, because you arrive in China, especially Beijing, Shanghai, university environment, you're surrounded by other foreigners and lots of Chinese who speak and were really eager to practice their English. So for me, actually, getting into comedy was, I mean, that was one of the ways I just thought would be a fun way, kind of like you might watch American TV dramas now, right? If you want to learn, practice your English, you watch Breaking Bad the latest House of Cards or something.
Right.
For me, I just thought this is a great way to learn sort of real the language of the real people, and also learn a little bit of a perception of what they think is funny, what makes them laugh, right? Because that's something that touches people very deeply, so it's a way to really get into sort of the Chinese psyche.
And do you think it's different, and do you think that it's different from a Canadian or an Australian or an American?
No, well, my fundamental bias that I bring to all of this work is that we're not that different as we think, but we often cling to difference because, you know, I'll go to universities. I often now travel around and do my comedy shtick plus sort of humorous lecture at Chinese universities all around China. Yesterday I was in Chongqing doing a similar event. And I notice, you know, and I'll sometimes promote the idea that I'm coming to talk about Chinese and Western culture. And I notice, you know, I'll just say I'm coming to talk about Zhongwai Wenhua, and they'll always put Chai on. So I'm coming to talk about cultural differences. Mm. Well, how did you know I was coming to talk about cultural differences? Maybe I'm coming to talk about cultural similarities, right?
So it's just a presumption that as soon as you have those two things, they're oppositional.
But I noticed that on both sides of the fence, on both sides of the story, I mean, as Western Chinese, of course, loves this idea that we are an ancient people and very complex, and foreigners will never quite understand us. We're very distinct. But in the West, I think we also cling to this idea that it's the exotic Orient, and they're so different, and all this wonderful, bizarre customs and food and everything. It's the difference that actually attracts us, and that's one of the points I often focus on in my university talks. Is that, you know, when we talk about difference isn't a barrier. Difference is, I mean, I often use sort of the perhaps a sexual analogy, just to say, you know, men and women are different, but that difference actually attracts us to each other. Sure, we have, you know, we have differences, and maybe sometimes it rubs the wrong way, but in general, difference is something. You know, if Chinese language and culture wasn't different from my own language and culture, why would I bother studying it? And if the world wasn't full of different cultures and languages, what an incredibly boring world that would be.
It would be a very dull place.
So, yeah, let's stop talking about the difference as being a barrier. And secondly, you know, even though difference is more sexy and more attractive and more, you know, it's the clash, cultural clash and cultural shock is always much more dramatic and interesting. But in fact, when we spend all of our time talking about cultural difference, we miss sometimes the perception that, in fact, you know, maybe we're talking about a 20% difference and we've got 80% similarity, but we never spend any time talking about that 80%.
Yeah, that's right. What we might have in common. So you've been in China for almost 30 years, and we were sort of talking a little bit about friendship and how that you became seen as a friend of China. And this us and them narrative that we were just talking about, did that play a role in why you stayed in China from the beginning?
Well, of course, when I arrived in China, it was a very unique historical period. I remember as a university student in Toronto, at the University of Toronto in 1986, 87, and hearing news that there was a student movement in China and thinking, oh, darn, here I am, a university student, and I missed it, right? And then, of course, I arrived in the middle of the big one. I arrived in September of 88 and was here all the way through 1989, on television before that, and then, of course, presented with the question of what do I do now? I mean, I've just had this great year in China. I've really expanded my understanding of China, and I have this burgeoning career as a TV performer, and I'm not sure where that's going to lead, but really, do I want to just drop it all now? And I remember thinking after Tiananmen Square, you know, if I follow the evacuation orders that the Canadian embassy is providing, they weren't necessarily providing transportation, but, you know, facilitating people to go back to Canada. I thought, if I go back now, I can't afford to come back to China. I'm a poor university student like everyone else. And so I stayed on, and I really tried to keep my ear to the ground. I remember in the middle of June, I stayed for a week or so after Tiananmen Square. And I remember stopped in the street once, or just with a crowd of people, and this one gentleman just turned to me and said, really sincerely, he said, you know, our country's kind of having a rough time right now, and maybe it's time for you to take a break, but do come back. You know, and I thought, you know, that's just one individual, but that sort of resonated. And I thought, okay, it's time for me to move off. And I went and I traveled around the south of China again, because I couldn't afford to get back to Canada and back again. And I came back to Beijing in August, September of that year to resume my studies just as a university student. And the feeling I was picking up there was that was very different from the perception we had in the Western media that, you know, this is something we need to take a stand and we need to show China this is not appropriate and we need to boycott and we need to stay, we know we need to disengage with China to teach them a lesson sort of thing. And the impression I was getting from people, students, friends, strangers, you know, obviously I'm a television celebrity already, so people are coming up to me in the street and everything. Was that perception was just totally different. And, you know, just a sense of, boy, you're still here, thanks. You know, I remember went on TV the next year, and if you listen to the recording, the TV recording, there's a huge round of applause that comes up just when they announce my name. And I realized that the perception is, here's this guy who's still here. I mean, we've been through this tragedy. I don't think anyone in China, it doesn't matter what your political perspective is, I don't think anyone thinks of it as not as a tragedy. So we've, no matter what your perspective, we've been through this tremendous tragedy, and here's this foreigner who's still here, who's a real friend of China, because he's not one of those fair weather friends. It's a very common perception in China that, you know, when foreigners say they love China, really what they love making money here, right?
Right, and this is a very, very pertinent point, because
you get that all the time.
The Chinese media is currently quite critical of Australia in both the in some parts of the formal media, but also in some of the social media, that Australia is a fair weather friend of China, and that Australia is interested in the economic opportunities, but is also at the same time more than happy to stand up and scold China or peeping China. And you know, not very long ago, Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop made some comments in Singapore about China and democracy and its appropriateness as a leader in the world, and the Chinese media responded quite sensitively, quite negatively, and with comments like, you know, Australia is not a real friend of China's. You just want to, you know, take from us economically with one hand, and then scold us and slap us with the other hand. So, I mean, Australia often tries to paint itself as a true friend of China, but I think we perhaps misunderstand what it means from a Chinese point of view.
Well, that's an easy accusation, of course, because, you know, even I my career is in China, so obviously I'm making money in China.
Mm.
And I occasionally get criticism for that. Oh, you're still here, you know, you still haven't cashed in quite enough.
Oh, right.
So,
okay.
You know, on one hand, it's important not to take sort of internet commentary too seriously, because you get everything on the internet.
Absolutely.
I think also a fundamental point of my career, or the way I present myself in China, or the way I engage with China, is to try to, as much as possible, avoid the perception that I'm a representative of the Canadian government, or that the Canadian government speaks for me.
Mm.
In a sense, you know, because Canada is a democratic country, the Canadian government does speak for me, right? Mm. But there's a government-to-government relationship. And for me as a performer, it's very important to maintain that I'm an individual performer dealing with Chinese audiences. So if the Canadian foreign minister said something controversial or something, it doesn't directly impact on me. I'd have to say, you know, even in the 30 years or 29 years I've been here, of course, there have been ups and downs in the Canada-China relationship. And in many ways, although Australia is closer to China just by geographical reasons, but in many ways, I suppose the Canadian relationship with China is similar. And there have been ups and downs. Everybody knows that there was sort of Stephen Harper's conservative government was a downtime between Canada-China relations, and now Justin Trudeau, we're sort of back on track. But I have to say, really, in that 29 years of working in China, my career hasn't been directly impacted by Canada-China relations.
Mm.
And of course, that's based on the premise that, in general, the relations are healthy, right? They're progressing. So people like me, at a ground level, are able to continue our work
to function.
But I try to avoid sort of getting tied up in a discussion of what a Canadian foreign minister said, or, you know, what the Canadian prime minister said.
Absolutely.
And really make sure. Yeah. And again, I think that's something that's actually difficult to portray in China, because you'll very rarely hear any sort of independent discussion of foreign policy in China from Chinese citizens. I'm not talking about Chinese foreign policy professionals, but from Chinese citizens, there's much more of sort of an understanding that we're on the same page, right? And whatever happens in the South China Sea, or relations between China and the Philippines and whatnot, you very rarely hear any kind of independent discussion of that.
So there's generally consensus. People share the same perspective, more or less.
So for me to say, well, you know, I don't really, you know, I'm an individual and the Canadian government is the Canadian government, and that's two totally different things. That whole sort of concept is a little bit difficult to portray in China.
Right, that's true.
But I keep at it.
That's right. Now, just on this question of friendship, and given your excellent grasp of the complexities of the Chinese language, I want to run this past you. In 2008, the former Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, or Liu Keqiang, who was famous for his ability to speak Mandarin, and he came to Beijing, and he went to Beida, the right. Peking University, and he gave a speech to the students there in which he described the relationship between the two countries as not as pengyoumen, friends, but as zhengyoumen, which has a different meaning to it. And it's sort of, I think he meant it in terms of, you know, we're real friends, true friends, not just this kind of surface level stuff, but we've got something really deep going on. But it didn't go down so well. How do you read that?
Well, I would give him an A for effort.
Right, but...
and it is, you know, it's a Confucian concept, and it's traditional Chinese, you know, it's right from the Analects of Confucius and everything, and it's a great way to balance that pressure that I think Western politicians feel in China, that you want to engage China, but you also have to play to your constituency back at home that wants you, you know, not to be too close.
Right, and your own national interests.
And that was a great way for him to try and balance that, and it plays well to a Western audience, but it really doesn't play well to a Chinese audience at all. And I noticed... when we talked before the interview, and I did a quick update, searched on Baidu to see, you know, what is the Chinese explanation of what zhengyou means, and you know, the implication is that it's a friend who can provide honest advice to a hot-headed friend. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you say you're my zhengyou, you're just saying I'm a hothead.
Yeah, yeah, and I need to give you the advice that, you know, the wise sage counsel that you require.
And yeah, so that in itself is a little bit insulting.
Right.
And so, this is already quite a few years ago, and I have to say I've never heard anyone discuss this concept of zhengyou outside of the concept of Kevin Rudd.
Right.
Outside of that context of Kevin Rudd. He seems to be the only one talking about it, and I don't think it's really getting anywhere in China, but I did think it was a good effort.
Right. Well, that's very, very generous of you. Now, on this question of you know, messages being miscommunicated and misperceptions, it seems to be a lot to do with, and we sort of referred to this a little bit before, about this strong sense of Chinese self-identity and this understanding that we are Chinese, 我们中国人, and then there's the rest of the world, and that's a kind of undifferentiated mass, 你们外国人.
Yeah.
Have you found that, have you experienced that in your time in China, and what do you think what is this kind of strong Chinese sense of self-identity?
Yeah, well, you certainly feel, you get a really strong sense of banging your head on a wall trying to work against that, because it's so deeply ingrained in the language and the Chinese psyche. Of course, language has a huge impact on the way we think of things. The words or the terms we use often sort of frame our intellectual framework, and vice versa, right? The way we think influences the way we speak. And in China, it's just so common for everything to be divided into Zhong and Wai. And I think, well, even let's put aside Canada or Australia as two middle powers for a moment. Let's look at America as, you know, the number one superpower in the world. I don't think Americans even think of the world in those terms as America and everything else. Mm-hmm. But that's linguistically and philosophically the way China approaches the world. That there is, and they understand that the world is diverse, but still there's China and the world. I mean, I often people talk about, you know, everything has to be framed in those terms. And I sometimes use an example, like, for instance, I say, do you know, if we're talking about someone in Shanghai emigrating to New York, let's take this theoretical situation where they're trying to make a choice of emigrating to New York or going to live in a village in Shanbei or something. What's the bigger cultural shock? I mean, the bigger cultural difference is going to be going to the interior of China. Mm-hmm. They're going to go to New York. From Shanghai to New York is not actually that big a cultural gap. But, you know, everything is framed in those terms, zhong un wai. So, of course, as a foreigner, and I never negate that. I never try to pretend I'm Chinese or something. I just try to pretend I'm part of the scene here, right? Mm-hmm. I am who I am. But that doesn't mean that I'm a complete stranger.
Right.
So being a foreigner, being a Canadian, that's part of my identity. But I've also spent a lot of time in China, and I've obviously had, you know, a lot of Chinese influences. And And you know, these are layers of identity. So for instance, Chinese Australians or Chinese Canadians, it's that cliche question, are you Chinese or are you Australian?
Right.
Well, somehow you're both, right? Those are layers of identity. You can still be Australian and Chinese. I think back in China, that concept, it's still, and linguistically, it's a real problem. I mean, we see this all the time in Canada, Chinese in Canada in a very, you know, population with a large population like in a Canadian city like Vancouver with a large Chinese population, you'll see people still talking about Wagwan, mm-hmm. when, you know, foreigners, when they really were just referring to everyone except for us.
Right,
you know?
Absolutely.
Everyone except Chinese, yeah.
So even they take that identity with them when they go overseas.
Yeah, although I would have to say that is changing. I think this is probably the same in Australia. For instance, you're getting concepts in overseas Chinese communities where they'll talk, for instance, about Xiren, a Westerner.
Mm-hmm.
People in inside China don't use that term. So inside China, it's still Wagwan or, right. you know, or Canadian or Australian. But Xiren, just in terms of being a Westerner, as opposed to Huaren, which are Chinese. So take the concept of Guo or nationality out of it altogether. That's very common in Toronto and Vancouver. And I imagine it's the same in cities with large Chinese communities like Sydney and Melbourne as well.
Right.
So I think gradually that's changing, but very, very
slowly.
But
only outside of China. Outside of China, they're differentiating as West from other, but inside of China, it's pretty simply China versus China and the rest of the world.
Yeah, and that's just the way they approach everything. So every time I get a question, it's always, what do you think as a foreigner?
Mm.
And I sometimes use the example, again, to go back to, you know, male-female kind of reference. Okay, I'm a male, you're a female. So, but, I mean, not everything I think and do and believe is because I'm a male.
Mm.
I'm sure that has an influence.
Mm.
I am who I am, but not, you know, as a male, you know, what do you like to eat? Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Same thing my wife likes to eat,
no,
actually.
That's not possible. She's a female. So do you think, just going back to this point about this sense of us Chinese and new foreigners, do you think, how do you feel about the idea that that from a Chinese point of view, that those identities are at all permeable? That a Chinese person can become a Canadian or an Australian, or that an Australian or a Canadian could become Chinese. How does that fit in with this Waiguoren, Womanjongoren point of view?
Well, I don't know. I have to say I'm rather pessimistic about it. And sometimes I think, okay, this is maybe, you know, this is middle-age pessimism and burnout and cynicism coming through, and that's something I have to fight against. But I, at the same time, I do think, you know, from my first contact with learning Chinese and everything in the 1980s and sort of thinking we're entering a new age, and then the internet age, and all these things are going to change, right? The world, the you know, the global village, it's becoming a reality. And I'm more skeptical, just perhaps even just in the last 5 years. I mean, has the information revolution really brought us together? I mean, it's technically enabled us to talk with someone in Malawi just as easy as we can talk to someone next door. But do we? No, we don't. We don't. And we see this really increasingly now, that social media has led to, you know, even has really strongly reinforced the bubbles that we live in.
Mm.
So whereas, you know, I mean, look at American politics. 20 years ago, everyone watched the same news, but now you watch your news and I watch my news.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of bubble has been reinforced. I mean, there's a huge bubble between the international internet and the Chinese internet.
Right.
But I find, honestly, the perception in China is not, there's not a huge backlash against the Great Firewall. Or the fact that Twitter and Facebook are blocked, people are aware, and it's kind of irrelevant because, well, we've got Baidu and we've got WeChat and we've got Weibo. What do we need Twitter for anyway?
Right. So there's no sense that there's a world out there that they want to be a part of. They're quite content with the world that they've got.
I think so, yeah. But I mean, and obviously that's reinforced by political policy,
right.
and legal restrictions in China. But even in the West, I mean, how many people really reach outside of their own media bubble and read somebody else's media?
Mm.
And so, I mean, this is very pertinent to my work because this is really what I feel I'm doing. The very first semester I spent at Beijing University, I realized I had been in China for 2 or 3 months already, And I'd made a whole bunch of American, Japanese, and African, and I even met a few North Koreans at in the university back then. I had more North Korean friends than I had Chinese friends.
Yeah.
And I just realized, if I'm going to break out of this sort of foreign expat, foreign student bubble, I'm going to have to make the effort myself. So I did that very simply by no longer going to the foreign student cafeteria. I went out to the Chinese students cafeteria and had lunch with them.
Right.
And I think that still today, if you're going to break out of that bubble, you can't just sit back and complain about other people living in a bubble. You've got to get out of it yourself.
And how was it received, 29 years ago when you went into the Chinese cafeteria? Were you welcomed?
Yeah, very warmly received, actually. That's the thing. And this is something that I often say, Chinese in Canada, and I'm sure the same, again, is true for Australia, often complain about this social bubble that they live in, that mainstream society, there's a bamboo ceiling, we can't break through the bamboo ceiling, and we can't really integrate with mainstream society because there's a barrier. And I have to say, I understand that barrier is there, but it goes both ways. You have to make the effort to get out of your bubble. And personally, what I've found in my own life experience is that once you do that, I mean, anybody who's traveled the world knows this. You go to a place somewhere where you don't belong there, and all of a sudden everyone's really friendly to you. And if you're in trouble and you're obviously not a local, all of a sudden people are coming to offer all kinds of help that they wouldn't necessarily if they just saw, someone who belongs here having trouble.
Having the same difficulties.
Yeah, I mean, that I think that's a universal human kind of thing, the really welcome people that make an effort to come out.
Right. But as we were saying, though, even though that's really welcomed and you get that strong sense of connection, a foreigner is never still viewed as one of the Chinese, as one of us. So although there's that warmth and that enthusiasm to embrace, it's still embracing you as an outsider, not as an insider. And I remember we were saying that the stories of the Americans who were here sort of through the revolution and became Chinese citizens.
Actually legally had sort of Chinese identity cards, Chinese passports, were legally had given up their foreign citizenship and were full citizens of the People's Republic of China. I remember in the 1980s seeing some of these, by that time they were in their 70s and 80s, but still some were still quite active. And one was a member of the Zhengxie, which is the NPP. What is that?
NPC?
NPC, that's right. It's so much easier to remember Zhengxie. So a Chinese citizen, member of the Zhengxie, this political consultative body, and still always referred to as 加入中国籍的外国人, so a foreigner who has gained Chinese citizenship. Not just a Chinese citizen. I'm sorry, a foreigner who has gained Chinese citizenship. I thought, boy, that poor guy. I mean, he's been in China 60s. He's pretty, 70 years old, 75 years old. He's been here probably 60 years, right? I mean, and he's still considered, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, I come back to this idea that rather than complain about someone else's bubble, I think, as a Canadian, for instance, I feel a duty to make sure that Chinese... I try to engage a lot with Chinese communities in Toronto, which is my hometown, and I'm active with the University of Toronto, because I think maybe that's where we can make more of an effort to show Chinese, yes, you can be a Canadian. And then maybe as a next step, that will sort of spill back into China to say, maybe it's not as black and white. Maybe we can get across this idea of layers of identity.
Great. And one of the results, I think, of this perception of us, woman Zhonggoren, we Chinese, and you, the outside world, is there seems to be a lot of sensitivity to perceived or real criticism, and that when comments are made kind of about China that are not meant in any way to be particularly hurtful, there's a hypersensitivity about how they are taken. Have you found that?
There is, yeah, and I don't know how we get beyond that. The boli xin, right, the glass heart.
Right.
Very fragile sort of national psyche in China. Obviously they're very aware of this history of humiliation, as they call it. And a very strong sense that we'll never forget. Which I often sort of cynically say, Chinese, you guys forget about parts of your history all the time. Why, but this part you really cling to, this idea of foreign humiliation. The Boxer Rebellion, I mean, that's a minor footnote in history that we learn, of sort of world history. But for China, of course, it's front and center. And anytime there's a dispute with foreigners, all of a sudden you hear references to Bagualianjun, you know, the eight country alliance that was aggressive towards China. I don't know how we get beyond that. And, this is the skeptical sort of middle-aged cynicism coming through. You have to realize as well that this kind of sense of conflict and us versus them is something that plays very well to political forces in any country. So Donald Trump can play that and Chinese can play that. And I think it's incumbent upon us as non-political actors to get away from that sort of rhetoric and say, you know, it's not us versus them. And sometimes I feel that's, you know, banging my head on the wall. It's useless. We're not making any progress, but we still have to do it.
So what do you think? I mean, this you were saying that it's something that's politically useful tool. So how is it reinforced, or how is it how is this identity and this sense of separateness reinforced, and why do you think it's and also these kind of particular parts of history, and why do you think these particular angles are emphasized and others are not?
Well, of course, there's the direct political angle through the education in China and the what they call the patriotic education, right? So the idea Sun Yat-sen said that the Chinese people are like sand. I mean, we're spread all over and we have no cohesion. And sort of the project of developing a modern country of China has been to build cohesion, right? To make sure that we're not Yipan San Sha anymore. We're not just grains of sand scattered to the wind. So I mean, there's a very strong sense of that sort of political imperative, and that's built into their education. But I think, you know, it's not just political brainwashing, to use that term. It's a very strong sense that Chinese people have of themselves, and we Chinese. I often say, you know, that's one of the big differences between China and Canada, is that we don't really know what Canadian culture is, especially maybe because we've always dealt with that sort of English-French split in Canada. And then, of course, now with a much more multicultural kind of country, what is Canadian culture? When we have a Canadian food festival, you know, okay, there's maple syrup and salmon. Well, of course, lots of countries have salmon.
And there's the chips with the gravy on top.
That poutine.
That disgusting muck.
But what else is there? I mean, there are little bits
that's
here
enough.
And there.
Thank you, Canada.
There's hockey. We have ice hockey. But, you know, we don't have a strong sense of cultural identity. And I say, you know, it really is a Canadian. I think that's great. I think that's why we're so adaptable. And that's why we think of ourselves as global citizens, because we don't have such a strong sense of identity. I mean, you know, this diversity is our strength is sort of an overused cliche. And I noticed now in the last year or two, the alt-right have started to use it in very cynical terms, right? They've started to make fun of it as if, you know, this is a scam. But I just think if diversity is not our strength, man, we're in a lot of trouble, because we're a very diverse country.
Yeah, that's right. So hopefully we can use it positively. So, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the sense in Canada that it's not clear what those aspects of national Canadian identity are. What about in China? Do you think there's a clear, rational understanding of, you know, we've agreed that there's a powerful sense of national Chinese identity, and that's something that's politically useful and constructed, as well as being a kind of a strong inherent feeling. Do you think there is a kind of clear understanding of what these aspects are?
A very clear understanding, but I wouldn't use the word rational, because you know, as I've been trying to work through these things myself, one point that really struck me was how when I was reading about imagined communities, and I thought, that's exactly what China is. It's an imagined community. You know, humans are a social animal, and that sort of sense of social cohesion or tribalism is something that's just fundamental to who we are as a species. But now in the modern age, we live in these huge, massive tribes that we can't possibly know everyone in the tribe anymore. But we have very clear idea of what it is, the tribe that we belong to. And so China is very much an imagined community that doesn't make a lot of rational sense. It's relatively easy to pick apart. Right now, it's just Chinese. What does it mean to be Chinese? Is it cultural? Is it racial? Is it your passport? Well, of course, the Chinese language is very vague on these points, right? 中国人 could be anything. So you don't even have to be Han to be Chinese. Except, have you ever noticed, I mean, when they talk about Uyghurs and everything, it's kind of vague whether you really use the word Zhongguoren.
Oh, right.
Or you specify, you know, Zhongguoweizu, right? Mm. So, I mean, it gets all kinds of vague. And then, of course, this is to kind of step into a political minefield. But when, people talk about Tibet and the Tibetan people being an inalienable part of China, okay, I don't necessarily take a position on that. But if that's true, why is Mongolia not an integral part of China? Why? It used to be.
Mm.
Why is the Republic of Mongolia now independent? Well, of course, that's stepping into the complicated politics of the 1920s and the international Comintern and the brother. I don't want to go there.
Yeah, that's a whole different.
But again, traditionally. We didn't have clearly defined borders, especially in a country like China. It sort of faded off into the neighboring countries. But now in the modern age, we have the borders mapped down to the millimeter and heavily reinforced by the powers of state. And that's something that we just didn't have 200 or 300 years ago. And I think we're still sort of catching up with that. Our concepts are still catching up with that reality.
So if we're looking at a kind of a complicated bilateral political relationship, say, between China and another country, Canada or Australia, and there's often concerns that there are so many misunderstandings and so much mistrust, and a lot of people a lot of times talking past each other.
Very common, yeah.
Right, and so what you're saying seems to me to suggest that will continue as long as each side is waiting for the other to come to its side.
I think so. And I think we have to understand, too, that the relationship between peoples and between states is always going to be different. States will always have, when we talk about sort of, for instance, values, Chinese values versus Canadian values or Australian values, often really what we're talking about are values of the state. They're not values of ordinary Joe on the street. Ordinary Joe on the street, I don't think our values are actually all that different. But sure, the states will have conflicts of interest, will have competing interests, will have competing values. National governments are very self-interested bodies. They have they have their own agendas. I as an individual performer, I try to stay out of that because I try not to be. I try to make clear that the relationship between Canada and China is not just the relationship between our countries, our states, our national leaders. I was at a conference about a couple of weeks ago in Vancouver at Simon Fraser University, and they were talking about cultural diplomacy and soft power and everything, and how does that relate to Canadian foreign policy, and how it can be used towards Canadian foreign policy. And I we're in the middle of the conversation, and I suddenly thought, it kind of makes it sound like we're here to serve Canadian foreign policy, and I that's just not true. Canadian foreign policy is there to serve me, right? I'm a Canadian living and working in China. Canadian foreign policy is supposed to be making my job easier. And obviously, as a Canadian, I want to make my contribution to the greater relationship and everything. So that when the Prime Minister comes, and I'm engaged in all these events and trying to present a positive, just the general impression of Canada-China relations, because I think that sort of impression is important. The feel of the relationship is very important. But fundamentally, I have to step back and say, Canadian foreign policy is there to serve me, right? And maybe that's my bias as a tax-paying, vote-making Canadian citizen. You're there to serve me, buddy.
We might have to take that up with the politicians and see if they agree.
Well, of course, politicians in China wouldn't agree, but I think that's fundamentally our political system in Canada or Australia, is that the government, I'm a Canadian living and working in China. I'm doing the work day to day. The government and the foreign policy should be there to support my work.
Yeah.
And I'll do my best to help make their job easier.
Yeah.
But I,
it's not the other way around.
No, hopefully.
So now, so Darshan, audiences in Australia can have the exciting opportunity to see you in person pushing through these identity bubbles.
I know. And this is really fun for me. Sometimes it's easier to do something really far out and experimental away from your own home turf.
Mm-hmm.
And I have done my comedy show. What I've been doing the last 2 years is more sort of Western stand-up comedy style of performing, but done in Chinese and you know, trying to make it as adapted to China as possible. So somewhere in the middle. And I have done the show in Toronto, but this will be the first time that I'll be at a major international comedy festival.
Right.
And of course, Melbourne is one of the largest comedy festivals in the world.
And one of the very finest.
And one of the best. And of course, a city that's full of Chinese people. Mm. 8% of the population now. But, you know, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival is almost exclusively English.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they want to break out of that bubble. The organizers want to have more multilingual programming. And I'd love to help out with that. I am finding it's difficult because Chinese communities in Canada and Australia, they're used to doing things their own way. They have their own websites, their own media. They have, you know, Chinese performers come to Vancouver or Melbourne all the time, but they don't participate in these mainstream society,
mm-hmm.
so-called mainstream society festivals. And I thought, let's just break down that barrier. And rather than go to Montreal or Toronto and break down that barrier, I thought, why not Melbourne? let me try it there first.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I'll be, in fact, I love saying this, I'll be the only Chinese performer at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. The only Chinese language performer.
Yes, slight caveat.
There is a small Cantonese stage, actually, so that's kind of overdoing a little bit. And then I'll be at Sydney.
Great.
The Sydney Festival at the end of the month.
That's great. And so where could people get tickets to these performances if they wanted to?
You can always find out a little bit more about me and what I'm doing at my own website, dashan.com. And for the Melbourne Festival, of course, I'm sure that's all over the media. For the Melbourne Festival, tickets are on Ticketmaster.
Mm.
And for Sydney, it would be Ticketek.
Okay, so it's Melbourne's April the 13th to the 16th, and one show only in Sydney on April the 28th.
That's right. And so if you just go to those websites and search for Dashan, you'll find it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dashan.
My pleasure.
Mark, and for this conversation. It's been so interesting to have a chat with you. There's not many foreigners at all, you could say, that know as much about China as you. So it's been really, really insightful. So thank you.
And I'm really looking forward to this Australia and New Zealand tour.
We look forward to having you.
Thank you.
Thank you.